Good morning. An EPA lawsuit over Kauai Syngenta workers exposed to pesticides claims the company violated the Agricultural Worker Protection Standard. EPA Western Region Head Alexis Strauss explains the standard and how it compares with the state's initiative to expand its own protection. Cancer prevention and screenings are at the center of an aspirational plan to address disparities across the state. Department of Health Director Dr. Virginia Pressler joins us with some of the first action items. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoot. Streetlight Cadence is home for the holidays with a new Christmas album and a full roster of performances. Singer Jonathan Franklin is with us in our studio. And Maui Farmers United is a coalition of farmers, gardeners, consumers, activists, parents, and educators. We'll hear from founder Vincent Mina.
It's Monday, December 19th. Those conversations coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on this Monday, the 19th of December, getting awfully close to Christmas.
Awfully close.
Good morning, Chris Vanderkoek.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Questions still being raised about the safety of pesticides, yeah?
And what can be done in light of what has happened in the courts. But we're going to talk about that this morning. As you may remember, almost a year ago, 10 Kauai agricultural workers who entered a recently pesticide-sprayed field wound up in the hospital. The EPA is now suing Syngenta Hawaii over what it says was a failure of the company to protect its workers per the agency's Agricultural Worker Protection Standard. Meanwhile, the state's agriculture and health departments announced they will expand a Kauai initiative, the Good Neighbor Policy, along with new components to the rest of the state. Better protection of workers is part of them. We called Alexis Strauss, the acting head of the EPA's Western Region, to see how the state's efforts and the EPA's standards compare. And Alexis Strauss is on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Specifically, how did Syngenta Hawaii fail to meet the Agricultural Worker Protection Standard?
When you spray fields, there's a responsibility to know when it's safe for workers to enter the field. And in this case, Syngenta didn't notify its workers, either in person or through signs, to avoid fields that had been recently treated with pesticides. And Syngenta then allowed or directed workers to enter the treated fields in Kauai before the required waiting period had passed and without the proper protective equipment. And because of this worker exposure, actually 19 workers entered the field, and as you note, 10 of them went to hospital.
So this is more than just supervisor error in a couple of instances?
I'm not sure where all of the fault could lie, but we are determined to completely change how this is managed. Working with Hawaii Department of Agriculture, we are going to ensure that there is more training so that workers are protected. This is completely unacceptable that workers who spend such long hours in the fields need the same kind of standard of safety that we expect in many other professions.
Hasn't the Agricultural Worker Protection Standard been revised very recently and with compliance coming up in January of this next year?
We are very excited about the new Worker Protection Standard that takes effect in January. We have been working with Department of Ag staff so that the training and other things that will really ramp up how well prepared we are, that will keep young children from being in the fields as agricultural workers, which is a remarkable step forward at long last after so many years. There are many different facets to the new Worker Protection Standard, and we are, at EPA, working hard to make sure that all of our states, particularly states with intensive agriculture like Hawaii, are very ready for these new standards.
Alexis Strauss, what are the differences between the two versions of the standards that might have direct implications on the EPA lawsuit with Syngenta?
The lawsuit pertains to the standards that are currently in place, not the new standards. And so we are focused, and I'm hopeful that we may yet resolve this with Syngenta. We're hopeful that we can bring about a whole new culture of training in many different languages. We can all appreciate that people who work in the fields may come from different places. They need their training materials delivered in a way that they can understand, that will help protect them from harm. So we're going to ramp up the training materials, the frequency of training, and make sure that people, that this never happens again.
When you talk about a new culture of training, training was supposed to be part of, you know, the existing standard. So to ramp that up, what would have to change aside from being able to do it in different languages?
It will also affect, as one thinks about agriculture in Hawaii, it's not just the company Syngenta in this case and the workers, but there are many others involved in the sort of contractual scheme and in the business scheme who need to be part of the training, who I think would be very effective for us to be able to reach. We're also interested. I had come out to Kauai to see this in late September and spoken with you then, and we're very interested in making sure that where someone may be harmed, that people in the medical facilities have the right kind of information with which to treat a pesticide exposure, which was a problem that we encountered with this terrible episode last January. So it's not just the worker and the company, but the many other people involved in the community as well.
As you look at the lawsuit and some of the things that you've just said, what would mean a favorable outcome?
A favorable outcome would be that the people of Hawaii would be assured that through training and through the data gathering that would be available publicly, that people who use the more restricted use pesticides and the day-to-day pesticides are protected, and the public has the confidence to know that we are all at the federal, state, and local level doing a good job. I think it's terribly important that children walking to school are not affected by drift or are not walking through puddles with pesticide residue. So there are many different facets of this that are part of our larger goal to improve how pesticides are managed and how the public and workers in particular are protected.
Public confidence has been so eroded in the past several years. In part, how do you see that happening with, or to be able to come back from that, with both what's happening on the EPA side, which may change as we move into the next administration?
We have a really good new worker protection standard coming in January, as we just discussed, and we are going to work closely with our state colleagues to make sure we have very effective training delivered. We are hopeful of coming back around with Syngenta and putting in place company-wide practices. We are very keen to see the work that's coming up. You know, we are at a turning point in Hawaii that is so very positive. The health department will have more monthly reporting of pesticide usage, which will be available publicly. We will have the annual training and medical testing for those who apply pesticides. And at the federal level, the U.S. Geological Survey is going to be spending $500,000 to test the water in Oahu and Kauai for pesticides. We at EPA are going to continue to bring pesticide compliance and enforcement actions in Hawaii where we need to with our state partners. So I feel that we have a very committed effort here, and I'm very positive about what we can do going forward.
You began to touch on the state's plan that was released last week as well. Do you see that as being, you know, fully integrated and in sync with both of the current standards that the EPA has for agricultural worker safety and what is on the line to come into being as we move into this next year?
I think that the Department of Agriculture is well poised to understand. We've been talking with our colleagues in California and elsewhere, and I think all of our states are well poised. It's just a matter of let's ensure, working together, that the training is really high-quality training, effective training, and that we are making all of the changes in the new worker protection standard. I had mentioned that you know, children under 18 don't go into the fields, which is, for me, an incredibly important step forward. So we're going to have effective oversight to make it meaningful and to win back the public trust that this is a safe occupation for people.
The bottom line is the plan is one thing, but execution is where it's all going to come together. Thank you so much for making a little time for us this morning.
Thank you.
Alexis Strauss is the acting regional administrator of the EPA's Pacific Southwest region. The EPA is suing Syngenta Hawaii over worker exposure to pesticides.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:13. Coming up, Streetlight Cadence moves from busking to the big time. But first, your quiz.
Mau, uka ho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a little town with a long reach. It's a center for, among other things, music, education, theater, and Paniolo culture. Its population was 2,258 in the 2010 census. From 1873 to 1994, its local economy was largely based on sugar, and the decades since the closing of the Hamakua Sugar Company have been a time of readjustment. But the community spirit is strong there, and the local People's Theater continues to offer a full roster of first-run movies, concerts, and other events. It's the hometown of John Wahee, the fourth governor of Hawaii since statehood, who served from 1986 to 1994. Wahee is the first Native Hawaiian to hold that office anywhere in the United States. You might also know the town as a gateway to the Hamakua coast or as the point of entry for Waipio Valley. And this morning, we're looking for its name. If you know, give us a call at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
I'm Kai Picaro from Sustainable Coastlines Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Streetlight Cadence, the Hawaii band that got its start on the streets of Waikiki, is home for the holidays with a Christmas album and another year's worth of performing experience on its resume. Jonathan Franklin is the lead singer and violinist for the band, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
You guys kind of came into the music business after it had collapsed, in a sense.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, everyone around us couldn't seem to draw an income, but meanwhile, we were street performing. So we didn't know any better. We didn't know that no one else was making an income. Because every time we went out to the sidewalks, we'd make more than the restaurants would ever consider paying us. It was crazy.
Yeah, and just talking about cash in the guitar case.
It was awesome. We could walk away with cash. We didn't have to wait 2 weeks for a check.
2 weeks, if you're lucky. But you've expanded beyond that into finding a lot of new ways in the new world of music to support yourselves.
You know, we've been a band of goals from the start. At first, it was I remember when we first tried to make $100 on the sidewalk, and I remember when we did, it was just we barely made it in change, and we were so thrilled. So we had to set out another goal.
Yeah.
And so the bar was raised, and then every time we set out for a new goal, we accomplished it. And then we wanted to make a Kickstarter campaign and raise a bunch of funds for a better project, we did. And then when we wanted to win a battle of the bands, we focused on it and we tried to figure out every reason why we would be considered a winner and how we could make it happen. Mm-hmm. And then we did. And then we tried to do another Kickstarter campaign. And then we won a Hoku. And then we won another Hoku. And then we wanted to raise the bar even further. And now it's become, can we win a Grammy one of these days? And so we just keep pushing ourselves, and we thought it was necessary to make a move to California. So we did.
In the this whole process, you need the ability to kind of step. Actually, you've got a camera taking pictures of yourself now. So
yeah.
So there's part of you that stands outside of yourself and looks, right?
Yeah, we have to be very observant of everything we move towards. And fortunately, I'm with a bunch of friends and coworkers in this band that like to be very critical and analyze what we're doing. We mm-hmm. like to see what's working and what doesn't work. And I think none of us were very good musicians compared to those around us in the context we were playing. Like, three of us were in an orchestra program, and I was the last chair in the orchestra for years.
Mm-hmm.
Chaz plays a bunch of instruments, but I wouldn't say he's the best at any particular one. Yet somehow we've got enough business sense and enough variation in what our strengths are that together we've kind of conquered more than I would have expected for such an okay band.
Well, you know, the things that make a band work, I mean, frequently if everybody's a virtuoso, you don't have much of a band.
Fair enough.
Right? But if everybody has a, you know, knows how they, what they play fits in with everybody else, then you got a chance,
right? Kind of keeps us humble, you know. It's a special thing to think that when I play by myself, I wouldn't get a crowd to consider stopping. No one would listen to me. But as soon as you put me next to this goofball who plays an accordion and another person who plays a cello standing up and another guy who can play ukulele or bass or guitar, just depending on the context, and he runs the sound, and Jesse plays percussion with his feet, suddenly it's interesting enough for someone to stick around.
Yeah.
And throw in a decent melody and some sort of story. I think it's getting people hooked.
The visual gets the passerby to stop.
There you go.
And then the music might get them to throw something in the guitar case.
I like to believe so.
That's sort of what the starting point was.
Yeah, it really was.
But now you've got, what's your latest ambitious goal?
Right now, we've got two or three. The immediate future looks like setting up a large Patreon campaign and trying to have music released on a weekly basis. That's writing the song at the beginning of the week, editing it and pre-production, recording it, going to the studio, you know, the whole nine yards, and then making a music video and releasing it by the end of the week, and then giving it to our Patreon supporters who are willing to help fund just the cost of going to the studio and just spending all of our time doing this. And in the meantime, we have a gig at Downtown Disney, which is kind of paying our bills, so I think it's possible for this to happen, and hopefully we grow a bigger fan base in the recording world rather than just in the live performing world, which we have been so successful in thus far.
Sure. But that's literally Monday, Tuesday, write the song, Wednesday, record the song.
You got it.
Thursday, shoot a music video, Friday, put it out.
Bingo.
Yikes.
I'm excited about it.
Yeah. But, I mean, you'll never get there if you don't set that goal, right?
Still trying. Setting every goal we can in front of us.
Let's hear a little taste of this Christmas album. This is The Sugar Plum Noel. You never know from the start of that song where it was going, right?
Yeah. We like to do things that are interesting in recording context as well. And when we were deciding to make a Christmas album, a lot of the covers that we were going to do for the Christmas album just felt too normal. And we considered, well, what else is available in the public domain that we can throw on our recording? And I was like, you know what, Tchaikovsky, the Nutcracker, that's all public domain music. What if we arranged something that we can use that's kind of Christmassy? The Nutcracker is Christmassy, but...
You bet.
The Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy fit really well into the first Noel, so we made our own arrangement.
But that's exactly the kind of thing that pulls in an audience, a different sound, the prominence of the accordion. Kind of, it started out with almost a drone coming from the fiddles, right, from the cello and the violin.
Yeah, yeah.
So you take an idea like that, and you really knock those out in a couple of days, huh?
Actually, that one we had finished the song arrangement in a day, and most of the time it's just rehearsing it and trying to get it synced. But now we're trying to push the deadline shorter and shorter. But I think we're allowed to focus more time on things like that than before. Before our career was mainly street performing on a daily basis. Even when we moved to L.A., we were street performing 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day, every single day. And that was just to pay for our bills. Once we had a Disney gig that kind of sustains us, we've got all this spare time that we don't need to street perform every moment just to cover our rent now. So we're really excited about what the future holds.
Well, Jonathan, it's fun charting you folks' creative direction. Thanks very much for coming in.
Of course.
Jonathan Franklin is the lead singer and violinist with Streetlight Cadence, the four-piece alternative folk pop band that started on the streets of Waikiki. The band is performing tonight at the Blue Note in Waikiki, and you can learn more about it on our Facebook page.
Jingle bells and Santa's elves, they never come around here. Old traditions that I never knew. Do you feel the magic of a Christmas? Help me find the magic of a Christmas. I think I found the magic of a Christmas. It's you.
Throughout the year, you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for news, information, and ideas. We're here for you, and we count on you to be there for us. We gratefully acknowledge Mark Cohen of Honolulu, Esther Solomon of Kapaa, and Edward Schorner of Waianae for their generous station support. Now, it's your turn. Before the end of the year, please make your tax-deductible contribution to Hawaii Public Radio. Call us at 955-8821 during business hours or click on Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Since the standoff at Standing Rock began, there have been comparisons to other Native peoples asserting claims for control of their land. But are there lessons for Native Hawaiians in the fact that the Sioux tribe has federal status? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So just earlier this month, not that many weeks ago, when the Standing Rock Sioux got that major victory in the protest, right, against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the federal government announced that it was going to, you know, block construction and they'll study alternative routes. The real question that some are asking, as you're posing in this article, is whether or not having the federal status was helpful in being able to get that study to move. Was it?
Right. Well, and would it help Native Hawaiians who do not have federal recognition? Well, I should add a caveat at the top. Remember, Donald Trump is coming in as the new president. He has some interest in the Dakota Pipeline and very much in support of fossil fuel exploration, doesn't think climate change exists. So one wonders whether this decision that the Sioux rightfully see as a victory is going to stand. So with that said, Nick Gruby, our reporter, who actually went to Standing Rock, talked to a lot of folks here in the islands, as well as some experts on the mainland. And it really comes down to whether the federal government recognizes any entity as having any kind of cohesive voice, any kind of authority. And the one thing that the Standing Sioux have is they have a government-to-government relationship. They are a tribe. They are federally recognized. Native Hawaiians do not have that. Now, as we've been reporting, there's been some change in that regard. The Department of Interior's rules saying if Hawaiians pull together a governing entity, we're going to recognize it. And yet you have this other group that's pushing for total independence, saying that's the only way to really have any authority over any over control over your entire lands and assets. So we'll see. That is the division that's here right now. And Nick heard a lot of opinions about which is better.
as we look at the kind of the frustration over a lot of the criticism from part of the Native Hawaiian community, does that really include the idea that having a government-to-government relationship, as has been, you know, floated by the U.S. Department of the Interior, would that actually be beneficial to the Native Hawaiian community?
I'll give you a couple of quick examples of people who think that it would not. John Osorio, totally pro-independence, longtime educator at the University of Hawaii, a Native Hawaiian himself, says he feels if you have recognition, basically you're co-opting any individuality, any sovereignty that Hawaiians might have. He looks to American Native tribes and saying they're essentially powerless when it comes to dealing with the government. Eric Seitz, a well-known attorney, agrees. And he's, by the way, done a lot of work with Native Hawaiians over Ko'olawe, Leonard Peltier, and other Native American groups. And he says, look at the history of westward expansion. Look at the track record that Native Americans have with the U.S. government. It is not a good one. So those are two naysayers.
Which seems to suggest in some ways that maybe, A, we're not ready to be able to make this call yet, or maybe that this is just sort of more conjecture than anything else.
But let me give you two on the positive side. John Waihe'e, the former governor, the only Hawaiian to be elected governor in the United States, says, look, federal recognition would be a weapon in our arsenal. It would help protect what we already have. When Rice Cayetano was passed over the OHA voting, he said, look, there's a chance we could lose our benefits. One other person Nick talked to, a tribal expert on the mainland, an attorney, says, look, if you have tribal status, if you have federal recognition, that means the U.S. government has to take you seriously. And that would be illustrated by what happened at Standing Rock. So this is a tough thing, particularly when Native Hawaiians, many of them cannot agree on the path forward. And this is only going to add, I think, more fuel to the fire. Did Standing Rock really aid independence, or did it aid federal recognitions? Well, reality check today, Beth Ann, the views are split.
Right, and which is exactly where we've been for a very long time. So maybe the overarching reality check is, until there really is a voice that emerges as being the majority, that this question is going to go on and on.
Right. That's your takeaway today.
All right. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair brings us a reality check from Civil Beat every day. If there's one resounding refrain about cancer, it's early detection means early treatment, and in many cases, a greater chance for recovery. But early detection, as well as treatment efforts, are often frustrated by the disparities in services and access across the state. Annually, about 6,700 residents are diagnosed with a form of cancer. A third of them die. Now the state has released its aspirational and strategic plan to up the access for screenings and care across the islands. Department of Health Director Dr. Virginia Pressler joins us in our studio this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning, Beth Ann.
There are so many reasons why people don't seek the screenings that in many cases they know that they should have, but very clearly sometimes they can't even get those screenings where they are. It seems as if telemedicine, though, might be able to be helpful in that regard, in at least having access to a doctor that might streamline someone toward a screening.
Well, certainly telemedicine is one tool that we can use, the technology that we have, in order to improve access throughout the state, particularly to rural areas, both on Oahu as well as on the neighbor islands. excuse me, but even if you have access, getting people to come in to get screened is a major challenge. So in Hawaii, for instance, we have the second lowest cancer mortality rates in the nation, so we're very proud of that, and it's probably related to relatively lower smoking rates and relatively lower obesity rates, although there's still a problem. But we have Native Hawaiians who have a mortality rate that's three times what it is for the rest of the population. And men in general across the board in Hawaii have a mortality rate that's 1.5 times higher than it is for women. And it appears that those mortality rates are related to delays in screening and getting a treatment, which can make a huge difference.
Of the top three cancers that people in Hawaii experience, two of them, number two and number three, are the same for both men and for women. Sometimes it can be more difficult when you have very different cancers that are appearing in either sex, but in this case, does that make it more, or at least easier, to be able to craft a message that encompasses everybody?
Well, yes, I think so. Lung cancer is the number one cause of cancer mortality in the state for both men and women, and colorectal cancer is right up there as a second or third for both sexes. The biggest challenge is getting people to get screened and to get the care that they need, and you know. Life happens. People are busy, and there are many, many reasons why people don't get screened. And so one of the things that I'm very pleased about is we're taking a very much more socioeconomic approach looking at the reasons why people don't get screened. Some of it has to do with, do they have a roof over their head? Do they have an education level that allows them to have a livable wage? Do they live in a community that allows them to be physically active, that's safe to bicycle and walk and things like that? Do they have so much stress in their lives that their cigarette is their best friend? I hear that repeatedly. It's very difficult to get people that depend on those cigarettes and substance uses to medicate their own stress levels. So until we deal with some of those socioeconomic and issues, we're not going to get very far in advancing our cancer care.
You make the point that none of this exists in a vacuum and that all of this is well integrated as our people and complex as our people. In trying to get some of those messages out and moving through the community to create, you know, conduits of trust, if you will, so that people feel comfortable to be able to seek those screenings. I mean, you mentioned colorectal. Not a lot of people are really crazy about having to do that screening because it has a lot of ooh factor mm-hmm. to it. But still, that being one of the worst cancers that Hawaii experiences seems to need a better message to go along with it at all levels. For the people who are in those high-risk populations, the people who are homeless, people who don't believe that maybe they have, that the self-worth to go off and seek that, or that because they're a mom or a lot of people are dependent upon them, they should be last. That's a different kind of outreach than, say, just getting someone to understand that this would increase their lives. And you mentioned that the cigarette being the best friend of a lot of people because they're under so much stress. There's a lot of subtlety in all of that.
Right. That's absolutely correct. So, what we're doing, instead of just talking about disparities as we have in the past, we're starting to talk about priority populations that we know are at higher risk. So that not only includes the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, but it includes anyone who has depression and substance use. It includes the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender population, people with low income in general, unemployed, those with a high school diploma or less. So we're trying to be a lot more proactive about getting to those populations that are at risk. Now, in order to do that, we have to go beyond just the public messaging that we've been trying to do for years and years. It doesn't get to those people. So what we've been doing is putting a lot more focus on educating people from the community at risk and getting those, like an LGBT population or someone from the Y&I community who becomes a community care worker or a social worker or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant or a physician, so that we have individuals from their community who are culturally understanding and trusted in the community, so they're more likely to get their message through to their auntie or uncle next door that, you know what, you need to come in and get screened because it can save your life. And the top cancers, the lung cancer and colorectal cancer, we could eliminate those almost altogether if we had appropriate screening and intervention. Now, more lung cancer today is due to factors other than smoking, not all of which we've identified, but still the number one cause of lung cancer and cancer mortality is related to smoking.
We've got to go in a second, but as you see this happening on the neighbor islands, the strategy appears similar, but it's going to be a bigger reach, isn't it, to try to be able to bring people in for what they may not be able to be screened for where they are?
Well, certainly access to care is always a struggle, particularly on the neighbor islands. But we don't need physicians necessarily for screening. What you need is community workers and social workers and others to get people into screening. Screening doesn't have to be in a hospital or in a high-tech environment in most cases. Most of the screening is very low-tech type of procedures.
And that seems to be the essential part of the message, at least on the neighbor islands, that this is not dependent on a doctor shortage. This isn't a matter of do you get into your doctor first, but finding other conduits.
Right, right.
Thanks so much for coming in. We'll be watching this.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Virginia Pressler is Director of Health for the State of Hawaii Department of Health. Her department has released a plan to bridge the disparities in cancer prevention, early detection, and treatment across the state.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. You've heard of physical therapy and psychotherapy, and there's speech therapy, music therapy, pet therapy, and a dozen others. But have you heard of philanthropy? Dave Pellegrin was grieving profoundly over the loss of his son. Eventually, his grief took him to the Compassionate Friends. They assist families following the death of a child. He began serving on their board and later was their president. While he was giving them his time, he noticed that his grief was changing. He was healing, getting his life back. Today, he's a firm believer that giving is therapeutic, so he and his wife, Kathleen, set up a fund that helps them to give to their favorite groups. These include the Hawaiian Humane Society, PBS Hawaii, and Hawaii Public Radio. A friend once told them, "The only good that comes from losing a child is the person you become." It turned Dave and Kathleen Pellegrin into philanthropists. Today, it's a big part of who they are. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Meli Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Alan Johnson. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, we'll bring you the Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, we're learning more and more about what's actually in our food, yeah?
That's a scary thought.
Yeah.
Also, what we eat actually is what we become. We're going to talk today about what are some of the good, healthy dietary tips people can think about, particularly around the holiday season. You know, we all go to parties. We all have a little too much of stuff. How can we reverse that or start the new year off right?
Well, the holiday diet is notoriously imbalanced, right, with an emphasis on sugar, for one thing.
Well, that and a lot of people just go to a lot of parties. And when you go to parties, you kind of wind up having food that you might not normally eat. So we're going to talk about how does that make people feel and how can they really restore their balance in their system? How can they make sure they don't have side effects? People have all sorts of troubles around the holidays, and we're going to really help set their diet on a really good course so that throughout the holidays and throughout the next year, they'll kind of be able to make really good choices for themselves.
So you can wake up New Year's morning with a whole new approach to what you eat, yeah?
Well, we'll give people January 2,
okay.
Just in case.
Thank you. Thanks for that extra day, Kathy.
Always.
And that's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies, as well as what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips for his expertise on both topics. Aloha, Christopher. Welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus and Mars in the evening sky. Venus will be the brighter of the pair and will set at around 9 p.m., followed by Mars at around 10:15 p.m. The moon this week will begin to wane, meaning a return to perfect stargazing conditions at the weekend.
And I gather that you have some holiday-related material this week for us about the mystery of the Christmas star.
Yes, it's a mystery that has endured for over 1,000 years. It's the mystery of the Christmas star, or as it was most commonly known, the Star of Bethlehem. In the Christian religion, it is the astronomical phenomena that apparently guided the Magi on their journey across the desert. There have been many theories as to what it was, and some of them may just be scientifically plausible.
So what kind of phenomena could have created the star?
Well, high on the list is a planetary alignment. These occur quite often, and they involve the brightest planets we can see, namely Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. If any of these were close together, it would look quite dramatic and extraordinary from Earth.
And what else could have done it?
Well, it's also possible that a bright comet passing near to the Earth could have been visible in the skies for quite a long time. But my favorite theory is the death of a star, a supernova.
And I always thought we needed a telescope or something like that to see it. Could we have made that observation without that kind of equipment?
Absolutely, we could have, especially if it was a relatively nearby star that exploded. And in fact, in 1054 AD, Chinese astronomers viewed a massive stellar explosion that created the Crab Nebula in the constellation of Taurus. Amazingly, this supernova could have been visible for weeks, and it would have easily been the brightest object in the night sky by a long shot.
And do you think something like this could happen again?
Indeed. Supernova occur about once every 100 years in our galaxy. And if one happens nearby, it will be visible to everybody on planet Earth. And the best thing is, you won't need a telescope to see it.
Nice one around the holidays. Appreciate it. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you very much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next week for Stargazer.
In today's backyard quiz, we told you about a Hawaii island town of some 2,500 souls known as the gateway to the Hamakua Coast. That's not its only distinction, though. Since 1930, it has been home to its own People's Theater, a community landmark that continues to offer a full slate of concerts and first-run movies. Now that the Hamakua Sugar Company, once the backbone of the local economy, is no more, the town has become a ranching and mixed agriculture community that is especially proud of its Paniolo past. Since 2006, the Hawaiian cowboy tradition has been celebrated on Western Weekend with children's activities, country western bands, a block party with Paniolo barbecue, a rodeo, and a rowdy saloon girl contest. It's where visitors to the Big Island headed for the Hamakua Coast can catch their first unobstructed view of the Pacific Ocean, a view you'll remember if you've ever been to Honoka'a.
And Warren Haynes called us from Wailuku, knew the answer, and will be receiving the HPR prize. If you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show. It's now coming up to 8:48.
Hawaii's farmers are determined to move our islands toward food independence, and it's going to be a long journey. In a state that is long dominated by industrial agriculture, Hawaii's small independent farmers have formed an alliance to make sure that our food future is in local hands, and have formed a farmers' union to advance the goal of regenerative agriculture. Vincent Mina is its founder, and he's with us by phone this morning. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
All right. Well, we're talking in the week that is seeing the closing of the last plantation, and it's kind of a reminder of what Hawaii agriculture used to be. How would you describe it, say, 30 years ago?
Well, you know, when I got here in 78, what I noticed was there was plantation camps associated with the plantation agriculture that a lot of the folks that were in those camps were growing their own food, raising their own animals. And so there was this essence of what an agrarian society looked like. And so it worked. The only problem with that trajectory, as far as an industrial level goes, was that it wasn't sustainable.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the soils were basically being decimated by them practices. And I noticed the sugarcane kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller in girth. And so with outside pressures from Costa Rica and such, I mean, Brazil,
You know, you have an issue where it just didn't become economically sustainable anymore on that level.
When you say smaller in girth, you're talking about the plants themselves?
Yeah, I noticed that the diameter of the sugar cane was shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what happens when your soils get tightened up from overuse of chemicals. And what happens is root systems do not end up going down deeper. It also closes the ability for the aquifers to recharge because water's not getting down to those lower levels. So it creates, it creates a problem. I mean, they were in business for a long time, and it's just the trajectory of their practices, probably got them out sooner than a lot of the people that were working for them wanted. And I have family that worked for the plantation, so it was kind of a bittersweet ending in that spirit.
It doesn't, you can't just make a transition from industrial agriculture to small independent farms because of what's happened to the soil, right?
Well, yes and no. The soil will rebound, giving the opportunity to. We live in a nature wants to collaborate and cooperate with us. And it's pretty amazing when you think about society, when we collaborate and cooperate with each other, it works. And so nature shows us the way on many levels. And so part of the mission of Hawaii Farmers Union United is to regenerate our soils, to bring it back to a place of vitality that we can grow nutrient-rich food that will be available for people to be well.
The old ag model was in part kind of fighting nature, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, we don't go down the road of making any form of legal agriculture wrong. Our mission basically is to move from the place of knowing what we know to be true, mm-hmm. What works. There's a theory out called the tropobiosis, and basically, when you are when you grow the soil to be vital, you're growing plants that are vital, which actually makes it immune for bugs to eat because it takes too much energy for the bugs to eat when the plants are expressing themselves as a complete protein. And chemicals and petrochemical fertilizers petrochemical herbicides and stuff block the ability for the plants to have this protein synthesis to occur. And so that's where you run into problems. That's why, people go, you can't grow without pesticides. Well, you can. It's just that we need to slow it down a little bit, take a look at what nature's saying and then be able to act accordingly.
Is awareness of what you just described, is that a growing awareness?
Yes, it is, thankfully. I mean, two of the things that are in our corner right now as far as this development is two things that I found in life that don't lie, and that's the body and the soil. And so because truly people are getting more sicker. Our GNP is up. Our gross national product is up, but because it's basically built around disease management. And, all the people that are just, a lot of families are in a big process around being ill. At 40 years old, people are getting cancer. And I mean, it's just ridiculous to see that, a lot of the maladies of our culture are built around, not having this awareness of our food being our medicine.
In part, what I see, Vincent, is a combination of new understanding and a return to very old understanding of agriculture.
Yes, that's right. It's a new old way. And we're fortunate at this point in time. I mean, me personally, right now, I started my morning at 4 o'clock this morning to do Farmers Union work, to be able to get ready to be on the farm when our crew comes in. And, we have this wonderful farm that we're basically producing a lot of food on a postage stamp for the community, and it's wonderful to see that you can have an agrarian society that can be supported by agriculture if you just be able to build a system around that. And I know the governor right now is putting in his budget to up the level of money being made available to agriculture, so we can have a more of a locally grown presence by 2020.
It's no secret, Vincent, that if you want to be a farmer, you'd better be ready to get up at 4 a.m, right?
Well, yeah, with people always say to me, "Oh, farming is such hard work." Work is hard work. But farming is essential. We need healthy food for our people to have a healthy society. And then guess what? People start making healthy decisions, and they really are motivated to be active in life. and to make a difference in life. And so we are at the most amazing place on the planet. We are in the furthest place of any other landmass on the planet, and we are considered to be paradise on Earth, yet we're not acting as like we are. And we can create this relationship in the transition to be in relationship with our tourists, system, to have the tourist industry work hand in hand with the agricultural industry. I know we had tours here on our farm, and people become educated around all these things, and they leave so inspired and so heartfelt that, wow, this is why I came to Hawaii, to see paradise on Earth, not a strip mall. And now I can go home and feel more inspired when I grow my own food. And so it really is about speaking to people's passion to want to be well and be okay in life.
The potential is there for an agricultural paradise in Hawaii as much as or more than just about any other place, yeah?
Yeah, there is. The only problem is last year's budget went from 0.4%. I mean, I tell people that, and they're just mind-boggled. I ask them, how much percent of our budget, agricultural budget, do you think we have here in Hawaii? And they'll go, oh, 50%, 60%. You know, I tried 0.4%, and then they dropped it last year to 0.38%. So, I mean, you know, we're looking at this is a you got to be kidding me, especially when they talk. A lot of the legislators are talking about, you know, becoming food sustainable and food secure and all this. But unfortunately, right now, it's a lot of waha.
Yeah, might be time for that talk to catch up, Vincent. We have to run.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for taking the time.
We have a good legislator coming, though, a good legislative group coming, so we'll see movement forward.
Excellent.
Thank you, Chris. You take good care, okay?
You too. Vincent Mina is the founder of Maui Farmers United, a coalition of farmers, gardeners, consumers, activists, parents, and educators that meets the fourth Tuesday of each month, except this month, at the Haiku Community Center on Maui. Beth Ann, it's always an issue with health care in Hawaii to have health care equal access regardless of your location in the islands. Yeah,
and that's in part what spawned the Department of Health report that came out, or the plan, so that there will be more people to do that. But it functions on many different levels, as you heard Dr. Pressler say, that it's got to be given to someone in a way that they can understand it and feel that it's compelling to them. And we're talking about at-risk communities. We're talking about culturally sensitive communities, those, so that conduit of trust is built, mm-hmm. and then these screenings can happen. And it's in our best interest because it costs us a lot, as you know, to administer cancer treatment.
And screenings can make a real difference.
A big difference, especially if you're a guy, get your screenings early. And for everyone else, too, just to pay attention and get them done and realize that your life is worth saving. That's going to do it for us for this Monday. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk with Washington Post writer Ashley Merriman about her new report on how leaders can be more powerful if they're humble. And these days, that could be a big if. And the final, From the Farm with Neil Conan.
Plus, we'll hear the musical side of surfing legend Tommy Curran.
If you'd like to be in touch with us, you can do that at 808-792-8217. Leave us your name and your town on our talkback line. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or want a pass run, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation. See you then.